This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
So normally we'd have Steve Lockeridge with us, but unfortunately he is ill this week. So speedy recovery, Steve. Hopefully by the time you hear this, you're back on your feet. So this week we will have Scott Atkins in Legacy of Lies, a New Zealand curiosity called Alien Addiction. And then it's off to the bayou for Vampires of New Orleans. Our short shot this week is The Speed of Time, and our DTV throwback is the sequel to The Philadelphia Experiment, The Philadelphia Experiment 2. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is Legacy of Lies. Ex-MI6 agent Martin Bully Boy Baxter is eking out a living as a bouncer and occasional bouts in an underground MMA circuit, with his daughter Lisa acting as his corner man. When a prominent newspaper editor in the Ukraine dies, Martin finds himself being dragged back into the murky world of espionage he thought he'd left behind. Okay, so we've had a number of Scott Atkins films this year. We've also had Debt Collectors 2, for example, earlier on, and Ip Man 4, of course, and now we've got Legacy of Lies. So this is a bit of a departure because it's not one of the usual directors he's working with. It's not Jesse J. Johnson, and it's not, Jesse V. Johnson, or Isaac Florentine. Who is it again? Rich?
Adrian Boll.
And this does feel like a different kind of film to me, Rich. And I must admit, I'm not sure how I actually feel about it overall. What are your thoughts on this?
I was very struck by it. I mean, as you say, it's quite strange going into an Atkins movie that isn't directed by Jesse Johnson or one of his other, you know, usual collaborators, Isaac Florentine, for example, usual collaborators. Adrian Boll is an unknown quantity to me. I mean, I thought he was a new director. He's actually got a couple of other films behind him, but nothing in this league. He's a Dutch director. But he's kind of on the basis of, you know, even the opening minutes of the film, I knew I was in very safe hands. It's quite unusual because the credits start saying Ukrainian State Film Agency, and then it says British Film Institute. Which was like, oh, that's really quite intriguing, you know. So we got a Dutch director, you know, it's Ukraine, mainly seems to be a primarily Ukrainian funded film, but it's got that British Film Institute, you know, input into it. It's set between like Ukraine and Peckham and stuff. It's quite an unusual mix, but it pulls together really well, and it's mainly, well, not mainly, a huge benefit to the film is not just Atkins, you know, doing great with I believe Tim Mann doing the choreography again, so all the action sequences are really good, but there's a strong element of drama in this one. It's much less throwaway, I would say. The characterization is quite important. There's the relationship with the daughter, you know, it's quite a, you know, the widowed, you know, father sort of character is quite a well-worn action trope. But it's quite well played. The young girl, you know, the precocious 12-year-old, I think she is. She's great. You know, she's a really engaging character. Great performance. And a lot of the other performers, you know, the less well-known people surrounding him are really good as well. There's that the Russian, I think she, the Russian villain lady who sort of takes the girl hostage. She was very impressive. And as well as the daughter, it's a spy movie, so it's a bit complicated with the various sort of factions and that getting involved right through to the end. And there's, you know, touches of Bond and Bourne. I mean, it definitely, especially a Bourne influence in this, which is quite interesting because of Atkins' own involvement in was it Bourne Ultimatum he was in?
I think so, yeah. One of the two sequels, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of those. So there's a car chase in it, which is like straight out of the Bourne movies, it looks like it. But there's some, I can't remember the, I think it's Simon Rowling is the cinematographer.
Mm-hmm.
And he just makes the film so much more, I think, than it would have been without his input. I mean, I already took note of his work in the Vengeance sequel, I Am Vengeance Retaliation, because, you know, that was quite a low budget film with quite, you know, basic locations, you would say, you know, quite sparse. But the photography of them was, you know, really made the most of it. And the same is true here. I mean, I've never seen Ukraine looking so striking. He found some great places, starting with that opening sort of bus graveyard.
The bus graveyard bit was particularly good, yeah. And it was a very unique sort of location to shoot in. So yeah, you're right, that they were able to get away from sort of the more sort of generic sort of DTV action locations. I mean, okay, let's have another look at Hard Kill, you know, the most generic action location you can think of, you know, the disused warehouse kind of thing.
I got this feeling that Simon Rowling, the cinematographer here, would have made a lot more of it. You know, the thing about this film is almost every single shot in the film is terrifically composed. There's a lot of attention to the lighting and the framing and everything, where the camera is and where the people are and where all the you know, the set dressing and stuff. It's really well done. There's a definite John Wick element in there. You know, you can see certain scenes and you think, hang on, this does all look quite John Wick-y. But, you know, that is kind of...
We have to ride that one out, unfortunately. Right.
It does look a bit. It's just those moments where it looks a little bit derivative, but for the most part, I think, you know, this is a very impressive film that I was really blown away by. Really.
Yeah, I don't know what it is for this for me. I found this in particular to be. It is quite sort of grown up. In its storytelling, it's very sort of morally ambiguous, you know, especially the character of Martin as well. He plays his cards very close to his chest. You're never really sure how things are going to play out, you know, because they're strong arming him with his daughter, you know, but you know, if he does that, that means he may be putting somebody else's life in danger. And, you know, can he follow through with that? It's amazingly sort of, you know, very, very, very grey in its sort of moral stakes and its ethical stakes.
Yeah, I think there's, and you find that with some of the supporting characters as well, because you don't really, if I can just see if I can get the name of the characters, so there's Sasha, who I think is the...
Yeah, Julius Roleplay. She's the Russian agent.
She's the Russian agent, is she? So yeah. So
and then Andrea Vasilov, Suzanne, is the daughter of
who comes and sort of gets involved so Sasha's an interesting character, because we first meet her basically in a shooting range, just assassinate, you know, killing the bloke who she's finished with. You know, we know she's not to be messed with, but there's she's got her own story, and they touch on it and they delve into it just a little bit, just to get a bit more drama out of what's happening and her with the daughter.
Yeah, absolutely.
The hostage. They have a little. They almost bond, you know, because they're talking, because she's got the girl. She's got a gift for knowing fighters' strengths and who's going to win and all this stuff. So they're sort of like talking, having quite mature conversations about stuff, and they end up, watching these matches and.
stuff. Yeah, she sort of follows in that sort of precocious kid sort of thing. We're like in what's that film with Ryan Reynolds? Not Ryan Reynolds, the other Ryan. Ryan Gosling and Gladiator guy. Fucking hell. You know me.
Oh dear, I'm not sure. I can't remember.
Right, I'm cutting all this. Russell Crowe. Yeah.
The wise beyond, I thought you were talking about a character or films, but the wise beyond her years character is, you know, a genre sort of classic, you know, is where, but she's played particularly well by this girl who I was thinking, I recognize her, I've seen her in something, and I couldn't think of what it was. And it was actually Maya Barath who noticed her and recognized is that the girl from the Christmas movie on that we watched? So, like,
the one with Kurt Russell.
No, the young girl, but she there's like these like TV movie style,
The Christmas Prince.
American journalist goes to a made up European country and meets a prince and stuff. So there's like a series of those, there's three of those, and she's the daughter, and she plays basically the same kind of character in those, but she was even younger then. So she's almost an old hand at this now, it seems like. I think she's been acting for quite a few years, she definitely brings a lot to the film. There's a lot of the supporting characters, like the MI6 guys and stuff, who come to
I mean, you know, for a Scott Atkins film, this is quite light on the old foot and fist action, but he does get one decent scrap with an MI6 agent called Edwards, played by Leon Sewer. And that was a pretty decent sort of fight sequence, I thought.
Yeah, and I mean, the fights are kind of peppered throughout the movie. This is more of a thriller than an action movie, I would say. But there is a lot of action in it.
It's action, but not fighting, exactly as such. Yeah. Apart from his MMA fight at the beginning.
Yeah, I thought I'd say I thought it was all. I say the whole package, I thought, was really, really well put together. I couldn't find fault in it at all. I think, if anything, it's not. I wouldn't say I love it because of Scott Atkins. Mm. It's more the other aspects around it. I think for Atkins, Debt Collectors 2, for example, is a much better film.
Mm.
Or for him and his, you know, him and his skills and his humor and stuff, which I think are better strengths that he has. In this, he's kind of more morose. It's a bleaker role for him because he's in a permanent state of grief and regret and guilt, and stuff. So he's not as
chirpy.
You are Accident Man, Accident Man. Yeah. Such a great character.
He's got swagger in those ones, you know, like in Debt Collector. He's got swagger. He's got confidence in this
that's
one.
What I'm getting at.
This one doesn't. Now, without spoiling anything at all, I just want to draw your attention to the very last scene of the film. And it comes...
Before you say that, I'm just going to say this has probably got more epilogues than the Lord of the Rings.
It does have one or two, yeah. And that's kind of the thing. There's a bit in the book, The Princess Bride, where it talks about, a happy ending is only a happy ending because you chose to stop the story at that point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of makes a point of giving you the sort of the happy ending and then the sort of more ambiguous ending, you know, to suggest that, things aren't as settled as, you know, it's not like everyone's just sort of, you know, dusted off their hands and went, well, that's the end of that then, I guess, you know. There seems to be more going on. But I'm just sort of thinking, from a narrative point of view, why would you put that scene in? Why would you rob your audience of a more sort of definitive closure? Especially since you've just given them that definitive closure and then you sort of like went, yeah.
Well, they've kind of got, I think it's one of those thriller things where they want to end with a sort of a twist, something that makes you intrigued and reassess and, you know, inclined to revisit the movie, which is what I did. I've seen it twice. I don't think I picked up on anything more the second time around. There's a part of me thinks that it's a development that is there for the sake of it more than actually bringing anything.
I think it's just there to pad out the running time, you know, almost. But it just robs the audience of like that sort of slight feel good moment. It's like, oh, everything's kind of worked out all right after all. But then it's like, well, no. And it's not, the thing is, it's not alone in doing this. I've come across other films which have done this as well. It gives you the sort of the nice pat, you know, the down pat ending. And then like 2 seconds later, it's twisted the knife in your back sort of thing. So, well, actually, no, not everything's gone the way you think it's going to go. So it's almost like it's a trend that's sort of starting to occur in action movies.
Definitely.
Worth keeping an eye out on, see if this pops up again.
Yeah, we didn't get in media res this time, did we?
No, that's good. In fact, I don't think any of the films this week have had in media res, so I'm quite refreshed about that.
This one, right?
Okay, I'm going to go with a 7. I mean, it's a solid thriller. I can't take anything away from it, really. But I don't know, maybe I just wasn't feeling the atmosphere on the day when I was watching it. You know, it is sort of a bit bleaker, a bit more, as I said, morally ambiguous. So yeah, a 7 for me.
Okay, I'm higher. I was on border of a 9. I did think 9, but I think a top end 8 is probably better. This is very much a must see, I would say, if you're a fan of this kind of movie. If you're a fan of Scott Adkins, you've definitely got to check it out. But
it's
mainly for, as far as I'm concerned, it's the cinematography and stuff that is the major selling point of the film.
Yeah, and it's good to sort of see, you know, a British thriller of this sort of budget, you know, sort of coming out and looking as good as this. So yeah. And it's not too long before we get to see another Scott Adkins joint as well, because his latest one with Isaac Florentine's coming out in November, I believe.
Ah, okay.
Which is Seized with Mario Van Peebles.
Well, that's the thing. I've seen the trailer for that. The problem with Isaac Florentine's movies is they don't have generally good cinematography. As far as
I'm concerned. No, that's true.
They're quite bland looking, even like the high end stuff with Antonio Banderas, the Acts of Vengeance, the trailer for Seized. I thought, you know, it looks that kind of low budget, sort of typical low budget DTV kind of movie, but I would expect a high level of, you know, high quality action.
Yeah.
Whereas this is a film, you know, Legacy of Lies doesn't feel like a DTV movie. It feels like a theatrical movie.
Yeah. You know, and I think it'll appeal more to people who aren't a fan of Atkins's sort of martial arts films. So there you have it. It is a 7 and an 8 for Legacy of Lies. Our next review is Alien Addiction. Rico and his mates are typical teenage stoners, letting life pass them by while they get high. That all changes, or does it, when a spaceship crashes in the woods and its inhabitants start searching for a special recreational substance. Okay, so this is a low-budget sort of stoner comedy from New Zealand. It was all self-financed, from what I understand. It is kind of bizarre, for sure. I'm for the most part, I really thought the first half of the film was excellent. It started to sort of lose its way a bit in the second half for me, but overall, I still thought this was a solid job. How about you, Rich?
Yeah, the first thing I was kind of leading on from what we were saying on the last film. I mean, this is shot really well. I mean, the locations are beautiful. The the locations in New Zealand where it was made. Very picturesque. And it's kind of one of those things where you say, you know, this is a fantastically beautiful location, but it's a place where there's a lot of poverty.
Mm.
And there's not much job opportunities and things and stuff. So there's you've got these wasted sort of guys, you know, running around just amusing themselves in all these sort of very childish ways. You know,
childish ways, but childish ways nevertheless.
Yeah, but they've grown up there. But you know, it could be, as far as they're concerned, it could be, you know, anywhere. You know, the beauty of the location is not really a.
Oh, it's lost on them. Yeah.
Engaged with or anything, but yeah, we first meet them, and they do like a race, and then they're like, one of them pretends like he's dead or something, and then they do another joke where one of them pretends he's holding a gun to the other's head and he shoots him.
Yeah,
and it's like they're like Jackass kind of.
Basically, yeah, it's that sort of thing. Yeah.
But it's quite endearing, and I quite enjoyed that, and it was quite warmed, you know, I warmed to the film from there. And I guess the humour, although it's, you know, it goes quite, you know, it's got that gross out kind of quality to it, because at the end of the day, the plot is about aliens coming to Earth who...
get high on shit.
Get high on... feces, yeah. So they human feces in particular, they quite like. So they spray it or something, and it transforms it into a smoke, and they breathe it. So that's the concept. That's the thing that's happening. It made me think of, and I haven't seen this, Paul.
There is an element of that to it. Yeah. And also Starleaf as well. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but that was actually really well done as well.
That's okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one. This drugs kind of humor kind of thing, it's not really my thing, and the toilet humor not really my thing either, but it's the characters who keep it going. There's some stuff involving a very overweight lady, which kind of is a bit too, you know, almost exploitative, and as that's kind of a bit of that kind of treatment of a person.
That was very strange. Yeah, she's
kind of a bit offensive. It could be offensive, really, but it was. She seemed to be sort of in on it and didn't mind. I believe she passed away not long after.
Oh no.
Making the film, so I think it was sort of dedicated to her. Mm. She was only 26, and she was a performer. I think she was like sang and stuff. Anyway, so she's quite a striking character in herself. I can't remember what her name, but her Jojo Waka is her name.
In real life. Yeah, she runs the burger bar, isn't it? Yeah.
She's in the burger bar with her mate, and they're all it's the kind. I think this is why I'm disappointed Steve wasn't here, because this is kind of very much in that kind of Clerks, Kevin Smith kind of.
It is
vain, I thought it would be right up his street when I was when I was watching it. So I think anybody who likes that kind of humour will enjoy this. The aliens themselves are quite. You just sort of, they've just got these big blue head mask things on, and they shuffle along really quickly and stuff. And that was quite well done, I thought. And it's the story is divided into chapters almost, and there's like a bit that flashes back, and there's a whole bit about a blogger who's kind of just making up stories, and he's kind of trying to exploit it. That's where the plot comes in. It's mainly plotless and like the last.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know what it kind of reminded me of was Morons from Outer Space.
Oh yeah.
Mel Smith and Griffith Jones. In that,
I'm not saying that.
Actually. In that, the first half is actually really funny. The second half, it kind of sort of loses it a little bit. And it's that blogger guy sort of coming in and sort of like abducting one of the aliens and things. That's sort of like, it sort of dragged it out a bit. But the other character I want to mention is the auntie, Rico's auntie.
Yeah,
who's like a, you know, proper Maori with all the sort of tattoos on her face and everything, you know, even though she's like 70, that was just like really, really bizarre as well. Just that sort of whole element, just sort of quite amusing.
Strong. All the characters, I thought, really strong, well performed characters, and I think this is the guy's Shea Stirling, This isn't his first film. He's made loads, actually, from what I can see, like shorts and stuff. But I think Alien Addiction might be his first feature.
Yeah, I think this is the one and as I said, I think he sort of self-financed it as well, you know.
No wonder it looks great, because he's a music video director. So right. So there you go. So, you know, he's done stuff.
I must admit, it's sort of, you know, when anytime somebody says, "Oh, I've got a comedy from New Zealand," I'm like sold, you know, because I don't think I've seen anything from New Zealand as a comedy, which I haven't been into, you know, films like Housebound, Deathgasm. And was it the Devil Told Me To, which I think is absolutely great.
Was Necrotronic from New Zealand as well?
I think it might have been, yeah.
Because I haven't seen that yet, but I do really want to. But in terms that neck of the woods, you know, Australian, because the humour is very similar in Australian comedy as well. And Two Heads Creek, I would say.
Exactly, yeah. Two
Heads Creek would be quite a good match. You know, if you like one, you'll like the other, I think.
Yeah, it's just something about that sort of, the humour is just, you know, laid back, but very sort of telling, you know, sort of very, very amusing.
Just check Necrotronic was actually Australian. It wasn't New
Zealand, I thought so, because it's the same guys who did, I think the same guys who did Wormwood.
Oh, okay. I'll be honest, I don't know if I've seen any films from New Zealand that I can think of. Sort of comes to mind, but as in on the basis of this, you know, definitely curious to check out.
Yeah, I highly recommend Housebound as one. And what's the other one? Deathgasm is quite amusing as well. Enjoyed that one. And of course, The Hunt for the Wilder People.
Oh yeah, I've got that on my list. I need to.
Yeah, that's a must. That is. Yeah. How are we going to score Alien Addiction?
I definitely think this is a lot of fun. I definitely also would say 8 out of 10 for this.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give it a 7. As I said, first half is really strong. Slightly loses its way from me for the second half, but still, it was a good laugh. Really enjoyed it. Some really sort of nice sort of pathos to it as well. Some quite nuances to the characters. So yeah, this is definitely worth seeking out. That is Alien Addiction. Gets a 7 and an 8 from us. Our third and final main review this week is Vampires of New Orleans, also known as Gothic Harvest. We'll get onto that later. During Mardi Gras, four women are having a good girls' night out when one of them is picked up by a devilishly handsome man called Gar. However, when her friends cannot find her the next day, they go to the police and find themselves involved in the curse of the Bourdin family. Rich, this is a piece of shit.
I didn't like this at all.
This is, I will sort of walk that sentence back a little bit. We will sort of get into this a bit more. But let's start with the obvious. This is not a film about vampires.
Yeah. I actually didn't think about that until after I'd watched it. I was like, because when we watch the screen and it comes up with the original title, Gothic Harvest, and I was like, hang on a minute. There were no vampires in that movie.
No vampires in this at all. That's totally missold. It looks like it's shot on video, which, you know, I'm not going to hold that against them.
I didn't mind the way it was shot. It's the way it was edited.
Yeah, the way it was edited. There are two scenes in this which I thought were really effective. One is when one of the girls sneaks into the house. Now, there's a character in the film in this family called Dolly, who's she's very sort of mentally deficient, sort of, and she has a collection of dead girls who've been sort of turned into mannequins for her. And there's a scene where this girl sort of like sneaks into the bedroom, and the way it's lit with these sort of human mannequins sort of in the room, I thought that looked really good. So points for that. And also the very final scene, which has the family sort of stood outside the house, I thought that was a very well composed shot as well, so points for that. The trouble is there's very little in between, which is actually sort of worth watching. I mean, I'm struggling really to sort of think of anything.
Okay, well, I'll say Lin Shaye is in there, and she's kind of become, she's become this horror icon now, who sort of is put into loads of films as like a major selling point now. And I think this has happened in recent years because of her involvement in some of the big budget.
Yeah, she's in the Insidious films.
Yeah, but she's, you know, she's got horror pedigree going back to, you know, roles in Nightmare on Elm Street and stuff like that. Yeah. But so her presence in this, so it's a good marketing plus for them. I mean, I think we've covered two or three movies in which Lin Shaye appears.
Oh yeah,
but she definitely adds some class to so when she comes into it, I mean, in her scenes, you know, you are engaged, you're quite interested in her performance and stuff. It's really the bland characters are around her that's the problem. And we also get Bill Moseley.
We get Bill Moseley in this, yeah.
Yeah, Bill Moseley with a big beard.
He looks like Joaquin Phoenix in this.
Yeah, I get what you're saying there. And but his character just makes all these jokes and like really inappropriate jokes, and he's kind of a quirky character. But that's I quite like that. I quite liked his character, and even though he develops this almost a relationship with this teenager, or you know, 20 something, which is really uncomfortable at the time. And you're
at least 20 years younger than him, yeah.
Way more than that. I mean, Jesus, how old must he be? I mean, he's been around for donkey's years. So there's a very, I mean, also he's got a beard and everything. Why she's like kissing him and stuff, I just didn't know why she was going for him at all. But there's some nice scenes involving him. But really, yeah, the other people around, apart from the sort of the really vampy one, who we get introduced to, I think, first, she's like the first character we get to meet.
Yeah.
She's
really striking.
But really, I didn't really care about or were interested in any of the characters. So we've got this family, and then we've got the almost like Spring Breakers, but they've gone to New Orleans to party, you know, like a hostel kind of.
Sort of setup, and
falling afoul of, you know, that kind of thing. I wasn't really interested in any of that stuff. The revelations and the sort of intrigues of, you know, what ultimately turns out to be the situation with what's going on, I didn't really care about any of that. But the main problem was the way it was shot and edited, with all these inserts and flashes and you know, the Avid Fart kind of thing.
The music was so inappropriate to this film.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, it'd be like a dialogue scene and they'll suddenly get like thrash metal sort of playing over the top of it and stuff. It's like, you know, it's just absolutely stupid.
Yeah, it was a big disappointment. To be fair, it's not like there's no decent takeaways. I say Bill Moseley and Lin Shaye are there to bring something to the movie, and they definitely do. It's just they're extraneous characters, really. They're not really. You could have had the movie without them. It's more about the other ones that you don't care about. The guy who directed it, it's his first feature. He's an actor. Primarily by trade, Ashley Hamilton. So this is his first time making. I'm just looking at his profile. He used to be married to Shannon Doherty from
Beverly Hills. Oh, okay.
And Angie Everhart as well. Model. But he's had roles in things like going back to like Beethoven Second, and then like more recently Iron Man 3. So he's been around for a long time as an actor, but not so much as you know, as a filmmaker in his own regard. Oh my God. So,
yeah.
He's done also, I definitely wouldn't be seeking out anything further from him, I'm afraid.
Not for a while, yeah.
Yeah.
He needs to hone his craft a bit.
I mean, to be honest, I might, if a film came out that he directed, I probably wouldn't even notice, because I probably wouldn't even remember much about this film to even remember his name. So I might, you know, I might well encounter one of his films again in the future.
It's quite possible. Yeah.
This is definitely not something I would recommend. You know, if you're a diehard Lin Shaye and Bill Moseley fan, you're certainly probably going to check it out. But for vampire movie fans, I think definitely
there's nothing here. I suppose the only reason they managed to get this other vampire thing is so well we did sort of drain that woman of blood, basically. You know, that's basically what we did. So we're
vampires. And they are like immortal, sort of, or at least
there's an immortal element in it. Yeah, God.
But yeah, it's they've tried to go for a really, you know, High Flyers have released this and they've changed the titles. They tried to go for a catchy, on the nose sort of title, you know. So, the Monster of Area, you know. There's a lot of titles you get. Like, I think they've got another one out, Werewolf of London.
Yeah, there is. No, Werewolf in England, is that something? Yeah, anyway.
Werewolf in England. There's Witch of Amityville. So there's you've got this, you know, villain of place, a kind of setup of a title, and.
Unfortunately for this one, it's just not working.
Gothic Harvest, even that title, I think that Gothic Harvest is actually quite a pretentious title.
It is, but it sort of fits more with it. I mean, the style of, you know, the family drama is definitely gothic. You know, it's got that gothic element to it. And the idea of sort of harvesting the blood from, you know, from these women to feed the baby is the harvest. So there you go. Gothic harvest. Fine.
Yeah.
But certainly not vampires. Long shot. That's too far a reach, that is. Okay, so scores on the doors for Vampires of New Orleans.
3. If I'm generous.
Yeah. I think I'll join you on the 3 for this one. As I said, you know, every now and again it does click in the right places, but there's so much not to like about this, unfortunately. So yeah, there you go. 2 3s for Vampire of New Orleans. Our short shot this week is The Speed of Time. Johnny Killfire must go back in time and team up with his former self to stop the Time Borgs from getting their hands on an app which breaks the space-time continuum by delivering pizzas into the past before they were even ordered. Okay, this is a nice 12-minute short. It is incredibly fast-paced all the way through. Very snappy dialogue. A great look to it. I absolutely love this one. Rich, how did you feel about it?
Yes, you pretty much said exactly what I was going to say. There's not really anything else that I sort of had in mind apart from to say, you know, yeah, a fantastically fast pace. I mean, last week we were talking about No Mercy, the sort of action scene kind of setup of a short, and saying that's not really a film in the kind of way we want to watch. You know, we want to have a real structure to a movie. You know, something that feels like a proper film, and this is it. You know, we've seen films what was the one we watched? Pizza Time.
Yeah.
I would say.
Oh yeah.
You know, which have properly made a proper movie, and this, you know, this has got a good budget. It's got a beginning, middle, and end. It's not just set in one location either. It's like multiple. Not even multiple locations. It's like constantly on the go. Different locations. If this is like a feature length movie that's just been squeezed together into 12,
giving us the highlights, basically. In fact, I think there is one sequence where they're literally, you know, it's one line, then the jump through time, and another line, then jump through time. You know, why are we here? Well, I've got to do this jump, and now, you know, sort of jumping again. It's like a constant,
And it's hugely irreverent. I would say, you know, as you say, the lead character called Johnny Killfire, played by John Hennigan, a former WWE wrestler who's made quite a few movies. I mean, this is quite interesting to see somebody who, like him, who's headlining, feature length movies to lead this short film. But he's great. I mean, he's a very athletic but muscular guy, so he's got that particular kind of presence,
which is quite funny. When he first turns up and he says, "I'm you from the future," and they and he's like 3 inches taller from him. You know, not only is he sort of built like a ship brickhouse, but he's also three inches taller than his former self.
Stem cells.
Which I thought was quite amusing.
It's him and Sean Marquette, I believe, plays the younger version of himself, who he goes back to. But it's like Johnny Killfire is just like completely deranged. he's just all over the place. He's like spun out. And it's really well done. It's kind of a variation on Time Cop, and I think if anyone likes this and then they haven't seen Jean-Claude Van Damme's TV show, which also plays with Time Cop, but obviously in a completely different way because it's with JCVD himself, but plays with Time Cop and has a lot of irreverent humor and crazy stuff going on itself. The two fit together quite well. I think as a teaser, that would probably, if you haven't seen that show, and you're not sure whether you'd like it, because the time travel stuff comes in later in the series. But so I just wanted to throw that reference in, because that's such a good show. And it only lasted one season, unfortunately. There's loads of great. I mean, Kung Fury, again, another short film that's sort of similar. It's like very irreverent, sort of very fast paced going. This one's, it's got random stuff like they go to meet the greatest hacker in the world, and it's a tiny little dog.
Oh yeah, and then just sort of skips over the whole thing, doesn't it? It's just like, thank you, hacker, for helping us out. It's like, it's quite cool.
Yeah, there's literally no pausing for breath in this film. Probably, I think of all the short films that we've watched, this is probably the fastest paced. It's almost like at the end of it, you go, I need to watch that again, because that was just almost way too quick for me. But I can't recommend this enough, really.
Yeah, this is definitely worth seeking out. In fact, we will put the link to this film into the footnotes, so if you haven't already, check it out. It was worth 12 minutes of your time. Very amusing, very well acted, great special effects, great little story. Check it out.
I want to just mention that it's made by a guy called William J. Stribling, and he has made a feature in the past called Bear With Us, which is on Prime, so probably going to check that.
I think we should. Yeah, owe it to the guy. Okay, yeah, check out The Speed of Time. Our DTV throwback this week is the Philadelphia Experiment 2. David Herdegg was the only survivor of a military experiment which ended with him being propelled from 1943 to 1983, where he eventually settled down. 10 years later, a military scientist has started similar experiments which directly affect David's health. When the scientist attempts to transport a stealth bomber from the USA to Germany, he sets off a chain of terrible events which completely rewrite history. David finds himself the only person unaffected by the change in time and must work with some resistance fighters to rewrite history again. Confession time, Rich. I've not actually seen the Philadelphia Experiment with Michael Paré.
Nor have I.
Oh, okay. you dove straight into this one. So this is a DTV sequel. Swapping out Michael Paré with Brad Johnson from such films as Left Behind and The Flight of the Intruder with Willem Dafoe, a film I really enjoyed. But here he's playing David Herdegg, who's now settled down. He did get married at one point. He's had a child called Benny. His wife's since died, and lo and behold, the bank's coming to foreclose on the house and all that sort of stuff. Just to add a bit of extra drama to the background of this. So a new scientist is trying to develop the next form of sort of stealth technology. And he's come up with a way of transporting, kind of like in Star Trek, sort of objects from one place to the other. But unfortunately, in doing so, he's caused a rift in time. So, Rich, let's go over to you. What are your thoughts on the Philadelphia Experiment 2?
I first saw this when it came out on video in 1993, and it had a really striking cover, and I remember the post, even because this was when they did this, the posters for this director video movie or in the video shop and stuff, which really caught my eye, and I remember liking it quite. I mean, it was a 15, so I probably wasn't old enough to see it at the time, I don't think, but anyway, we got it, and it made an impression on me. I think partly because of the stealth bomber angle, because that was everywhere at that time, you know, that was like the big new, you know, military technology.
Yeah.
You know, the aviation, you know, I mean, we saw them in, what was it? The, you know, stuff like Executive Decision and Under Siege 2 and, you know, loads of B movies and stuff, including this one, and the whole time travel angle and the Nazis winning, which is kind of been done in various other stories, like Robert Harris's Fatherland and Man in the High Castle, which has been a very popular TV show on Amazon recently. But so revisiting it, 30 years later, was quite interesting, because I was, you know, this was kind of a film I saw in my formative years. It was like probably one of the first DTV sequels I saw, along with like Darkman 2 and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And coming back, you kind of really see the low budget nature of it this time around. It's really, they really didn't have a lot to work with making this. And the whole kind of, there are very few locations and settings. And what we have is the lead character, David Herdegg, did you say?
Yeah.
Name? Yeah, so he's Brad Johnson. And he is pulled through time, or not even pulled through time, but sort of like time changes around him so that he's suddenly in a world where his son's not around, and he's wearing, you know, clothes that are completely alien to everyone else because the Nazis won the war, and there's a resistance movement going on. It becomes a resistance story at that stage. And then in the last part of the movie, he actually goes back in time to when the Nazis got hold of the bomber. Mm. And that's kind of the big climax of the movie. But that's, you know, there's, everything's in sort of very dark locations with, you know, not much set dressing. So I was quite taken, you know, I was quite surprised by that, because I remember it being a much more striking film. But also coming back to it, you know, you're watching it and you're seeing all these faces from the era that you don't really see anymore.
Yeah.
Like Margene Holden, and there was the guy playing, I think his name was Cecil.
The guy who plays the...
Cyril O'Reilly. The guy who plays the villain as well.
Yeah.
I'm sure I've seen loads of stuff.
Oh, he's been in tons. Yeah, he really has.
Garrett Graham.
Yeah.
You know, all these very familiar... I mean, he's really good. I really liked him a lot.
He was
probably good, easily. Some other... Oh, he was in like Child's Play 2 and stuff.
Yes,
like
he was. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was Oh, and Star Trek. He's done Star Trek.
Anyway, he's done loads of Star Trek, Babylon 5, all the rest of it. Yeah.
So the so that was my, you know, revisit. I was revisiting the film. Was this your first time watching it?
It was my first time watching it, and I actually watched this afternoon with my wife and son. So I was constantly barraged with questions like, "Wait, what? What? What's happened? Where's he from? Is he from the future? Which year is in the future is he from?" I said, no. So I was like this all the way through, basically, trying to put together the plot for them.
You know what I think is quite funny is today, we're recording this on a Sunday, and you say you watched it earlier. I think this is a perfect Sunday afternoon TV.
It's that kind of thing, yeah. It would, you know, back in the day, this would be. It's it does have its moments as a sort of, you know, he's chased on foot by a helicopter that's sort of shooting at him, and, you know, the buildings get blown up, quite nicely. There are some nice explosions in this a couple of times. There is a couple of really horribly filmed moments. That initial chase bit in the factory when he first warps in is a lot of handheld camera work, and it's awful. It's almost Expendables awful in the way it's done. And then later on, when there's the big sort of siege at the sort of Nazi laboratory, the camera, it's almost like they filmed it on a low def camera and kept pausing it. So all you end up on the screen is like a blurred image with, like, you know, lots of like movement lines. And it's horrible. It is literally horrible to watch. It really did sort of take away from what was going on.
This was directed by Stephen Cornwell, who's done quite a lot of other stuff, and especially things like he was a producer on Hotel Artemis, a writer on Unknown, the Liam Neeson movie. I'm just checking what sort of directorial credit. He didn't really have a lot. This was his third thing that he did. I mean, the first thing was a TV movie called State of Fear. Then he did a film called Killing Streets. Mm-hmm. So this was his third. And then he did a TV movie called Martial Law, which I think, I'm just checking, is it the Jimmy Smits one? It is. So he did Martial Law with Jimmy Smits, which I remember that having quite a high profile release over here. It was kind of back in the day when TV movies would get those, you know,
yeah,
proper video releases and stuff. And actually, it was an 18 rating, surprisingly, considering it's supposed to be a whether it was a HBO thing or something, I don't know. But that was the last thing he did. So I'm kind of not surprised, because I don't think he's got a huge amount of flair as a director.
No.
But I will concede that it's quite clear he was working on with quite a lot of limitations. I mean, the bad guys, you know, the Nazi laboratory and even his office, you know, when we see the Nazi guy in his office, and he's got the video footage, the black and white footage playing in the background and stuff. It's like, there's no set design much really going on. It's almost like Plan 9 from Outer Space, kind of draw a curtain across a...
See, that bit, I did kind of like that bit, because what he was doing was he was trying to edit in music to a new propaganda video that they'd made. And he's, you know, he's going through this list of, like, well, Mahler, no, Strauss, no, doesn't fit. And in the end, he ends up with like a proper American sort of jazz sort of sound sort of going on in the background, which I thought was an interesting sort of, you know, sort of very much like, who was Hitler's propaganda guy? Was it Goebbels? The other one.
Was it Joseph Goebbels? I think you're right, it was Joseph.
Might be Goebbels, yeah.
Yeah,
it was. But I got that sort of like vibe from it, which I thought was quite interesting.
And I'm just checking the IMDb. Stephen Cornwell, apparently, is the son of John Le Carré.
Ah, okay.
It's a little bit of interesting trivia. Mm.
No relation to Patricia Cornwell.
Unless John Le Carré and Patricia Cornwell are married, I suppose. I don't know.
No.
I don't think so. That would be quite funny. I haven't looked into that far.
Was there a second sequel to Philadelphia Experiment? I can't remember.
No, but there was a more recent remake I discovered with Malcolm.
So a TV version.
Yeah, like a TV remake of the first film. I've always been quite intrigued to see the first one a lot. Yeah. I always get it confused with The Final Countdown.
Yeah. Because the Philadelphia Experiment is supposedly built based on an actual experiment, isn't it? You know, there is some evidence that, you know, the government was experimenting with some sort of radar cloaking device sort of during the Second World War, and there may or may not have been an incident involving a battleship. But it's one that sort of the conspiracy theorists like to sort of embellish on.
But, another put actor from this is Margene Holden. She's got probably the most prominent supporting character in the movie. And she, again, she's someone we don't really see anymore. She kind of beyond 2010, she kind of disappeared. She was even in. she was in shows like Babylon 5 and Star Trek Deep Space Nine and whatnot. But I remember her being in quite a lot of movies around the mid-90s, you know, DTV kind of stuff and TV movies and that. So, yeah, she's quite good. They do this kind of overly cutesy wrap-up where, you know, things sort of dovetail.
Everything's back to normal,
way too nicely with, like, oh, I'm just... It just happens to be that I'm bumping into the person from the alternative universe.
But as I pointed out to my wife, though, it's like, yeah, but the bank's still got to foreclose on your house. You haven't solved that element, you know, unless you're going to go back working for the Navy because they promised to pay for everything. But yeah, I just thought that was quite amusing. It's a bit of Schadenfreude almost. So we don't score the shorts. The DTV throwbacks. Right. We don't score those. But we will point out this is available on Amazon Prime if you're that way inclined, if we haven't turned you off completely. It's not up there with some of the ones we've talked about, but, you know, it passes the time, that's for sure.
I think it's definitely worth a look. If you like sci-fi and, you know, that kind of thing.
Bit of time travel, that sort of thing. It's all
if you're into the 90s kind of...
Alternate dimensions, that sort of thing going on.
Definitely worth a look.
Yeah.
But it's not as... I mean, I definitely have probably stronger memories of it than actually the film, you know. The film didn't live up to...
That's the issue with doing this DTV throwback, isn't it? It's like, yeah, that was a really cool film. And then you look at it again and go, oh my God, what was I drinking that night? But anyway, so that is the end of this week's show. If you like what you hear, you can check out our Facebook page, the DTV Digest, or even on Twitter as the DTV Digest also. Or get in contact with us at the DTV Digest at google.com?
Gmail.
At the DTV Digest at gmail.com. I'm so behind the times. I've still got a Yahoo email address. Anyway, thank you for listening and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.